to a tragic story now, the sudden death of the young Gaelic football star Cormac McAnallan in 2004 caused shockwaves throughout the sporting world. The former Irish president, Mary McAleese, described the 24-year-old teacher as one of the greatest Gaelic footballers of his time. The Tyrone football manager, Mickey Hart, called him a gem of a man.
Well, I have to say I'm very happy that many times I had the chance to say to Cormac McAnallan, you were the best that you could be. You were the man. That's the language I used. I know my children often heard me saying it. You thought Cormac was the man, and I did think Cormac was the man, and I'm glad that I've been able to tell him that a number of times. And now I would say to Cormac is, you know, you lived like the man that you wanted to be, and I hope that the rest of us can carry on living the way you would have wanted us to do, and that we will always hold you in the high esteem that you gained for yourself, and that the rest of us as people, not only sports people, but people, can live our lives the way you would want them to do, the way you would want us to do it. And if we do that, then Cormac McAnallan will live forever.
Well, the Tyrone All-Star was at the peak of fitness, yet he became a victim of what medical experts call sudden adult death syndrome, a heart condition that is really, really hard to detect. His brother Donal has written an intimate and moving book about Cormac's life, death and legacy. And Donal is with me now. Good morning to you.
Good morning, Stephen.
Good morning. Why write the book?
Well, when Cormac died, it was clear from the immediate reaction that he meant so much, much more than we could ever have known. He was respected and revered more than we'd ever known. And there was a whole immediate impact, which lasted not just weeks and months. It lasted 2 or 3 years. There was a whole outworking of all sorts of medical issues and so on. 2.5 years even, till we were offered the prospect even of an inquest. And, you know, our lives just were completely changed. But back then, over a decade ago, I had it in mind that while people knew the story on surface, there were many more layers to Cormac's amazing story that I could bring. I had access to, you know, notes of speeches he wrote, personal memories, my own personal memories, things he wrote in diaries, his self-appraisals. He marked himself out of every aspect of play for most of the latter years of his life. And so I could bring all these in a way that maybe nobody else could. But the time was never really right. You know, we had to get some equilibrium back in our lives and get on with life, work hard, family. But when the decade came around in 2014, I set to work on it. And it's become much more than I anticipated. I thought just it was a matter of trying to capture his life story. But I've learned so much about him. I've understood so much more about him. And how he shaped me and I him, and how any brother or sister can affect each other.
Give me an insight, Donal, into what you mean when you say there are some examples of maybe some of the stories that aren't out there about your brother that made him special.
Well, he had this. He was all action, and he had this insatiable thirst for knowledge. I mean, he's devouring encyclopedias and atlases and all sorts of information. From the earliest age. And even though he was a year and a half younger than me, you know, I realise now when I go back through the diaries and things that we wrote at school and so on, that he was actually setting the bar for me in life. And there was this really competitive dynamic there, which you don't fully appreciate at the time because it was all I was ever used to. And I suppose it was so intensely competitive in every small thing, every game you could possibly play. But he was just so meticulous and so considerate. You know, he recorded everything. He was constantly trying to improve himself. And that is borne out by the records that he kept. And these, you know, these have never really been seen before. So I just give some examples in the book. And, you know, there are just the quizzes is an example. Like he took part in so many quizzes and won so many quizzes. And, you know, when you go back and you look through how his amazing ability to guess questions, things like that. I mean, it is remarkable the way he just did everything.
And your dad had built a pitch in your back garden, correct?
Yeah, well, I mean, we had a sort of a natural amphitheatre, you could call it, in our back lawn. There was apple trees on one side and strawberry beds on the other and a hedge on one end and a wall on the other. And my father put up two sets of posts and we have another brother, Fergus. He's a bit younger and he didn't have quite the same interest in football. But so mostly it was, you know, Cormac and myself and whatever sport was going, whether it was Gaelic, soccer, rugby, tennis during the summer. We were playing it on those sports. And not only did that, but recording the scores down and also indoor sports. But, you know, that's where the story begins for me, back in that lawn. And, in the, you know, that's where it ends as well, I suppose, when I cast my mind back and I reimagine things otherwise.
How quickly did you spot his talent?
Well, it was all I was used to, you know. I suppose there were wee clues. You know, it was hard to identify because, you know, he's younger, and when somebody's younger than you, you know, you're looking at the people of you're probably have that advantage of being taller and maybe slightly faster at a given age. But there were clues. I remember a time like when we went for a cross country race at Kilbroney Park when he was about 10. He'd never run a race before, and there were people there, obviously members of clubs. We weren't members of clubs. He just turned up and came third. Another time he went to the Mary Peters track, never taken part in any competitive athletics, won a silver medal. I can't remember the distance. It's in the book. But it was his ability to just adapt. You see, the amazing thing about it was he didn't look particularly athletic, and he didn't look particularly athletic. He was about 15 or 16. He actually looked quite pudgy through a lot of his teenage years. But he had this tremendous engine and this extraordinary desire, and just that he never gave in. And that is really what underlies his remarkable story.
The tragedy of what happened to him, I guess that the normal instinct is to think that that you must have a heads up that someone's sick. And we know that people drop dead, but dying through no obvious reason, suddenly, at such a young age, it's not just tragic, it's completely disorientating.
Absolutely. Cormac was one of the fittest people I knew. He was playing for the Ireland team in the international rules football against Australia. He had played for 3 years. And I remember him telling me that when he was in the rowing machine, he was one of the top five on the Irish team. So that gives you a measure of how fit he was. And nothing ever seemed to faze him. He just seemed to get fitter and faster. Even the fitness test that he did 5 or 6 weeks before he died, in every aspect of performance, even after winning the All-Ireland in 2003, he recorded significant increases of fitness. So all I ever knew him was to be fitter and fitter. And yet suddenly this happened. And, you know, at the time we wouldn't have seen anything which gave any prior hint that something could be seriously wrong. Yes, there were signs that occasionally that he was a bit tired or weary or a bit busy. But aren't we all at times? You know, that doesn't mean somebody at the age of 24 is going to suffer something very serious.
So what happened?
Well, it was the night of the 1st of March 2004. Cormac had been teaching at school in St Catherine's College, Armagh. He went to school, I went to gym afterwards with some colleagues. Came back about 7:30. At dinner, lovingly made by our mother as usual, chicken and pasta. Asked for more, all seemed well. We went in and watched some football on television. Then it was University Challenge at 8:30. My mother and Cormac always competed on that. That was over. Told him a couple of requests that people had made from to do various things, speak at functions and so on. And he said, oh God, this is going to have to stop. You know, this is becoming a bit much. And then he started work. There was he had some work to do for school. There was a lot on at school at that time, an internal audit or something. But so he started preparing his 1066 lesson for history for the next day. That staple lesson of all history teachers. And at about 11:10, he went upstairs. He spoke. He organised his things for the next day. Spoke to his fiance of a few weeks, Aisling, and went to sleep at some stage, I think, in the next hour after that. Now, once or twice, we tried to call to him about just some random thing, and I can't even remember whether he answered. That was just about ordinary humdrum things. And I'm a night owl by nature, and the time passed 1:30, 1:30, 2:00. I was working on some notes that I was doing, and it was past 2:30, and it was actually edged towards 3:00, incredibly. And then, with the door slightly ajar behind me, I heard this really loud noise from upstairs. I went out to the hallway. I said, what's up? What's going on up there? And this continued, so I ran up the stairs. I thought it was coming from my other brother Fergus's room, but when I got up there, I realised it was Cormac's room. I went in and flicked on the light, and there he was, laying slightly turned to his side, duvet sort of half, as if he was trying to get out slightly. His eyes were sort of staring blankly at the ceiling, and there was a sort of a mucus on his lip. And I tried to shake him. I called his name, what's wrong, Cormac? And I shook his shoulders, but there was no response. And I didn't know what to do. I ran to my mother, who's the most medically minded among us. She came in, tried to do a bit of CPR insofar as she understood it, and we didn't really. And my father came in. And we rang 999 and we waited what seemed like at that hour of the morning an interminable amount of time. And we rang a local doctor, Dr. Anjan Ghosh, and he was there within 10 minutes, tried to revive him. When the ambulance, when
and
the
he
paramedics...
Was just, was he dead by then?
Effectively so. I mean, the paramedics arrived sometime, and like I found him at 3 o'clock. The paramedics arrived around 3:45. They started to rig up the defibrillator, started giving shocks to him, in between which the priest arrived and started giving the last rites. And so the shocks kept delivering the jolts for about most of half an hour, but there were no signs. You know, when the jolt is made, you sometimes see the body move, but that was hope. We were hoping against hope that his body was sort of, that he was reviving himself, but that didn't happen. And eventually then after 4 o'clock, he was provisionally declared dead by the doctor on site, Dr. Ghosh, and then officially declared dead after 5 o'clock. And with that, our lives changed utterly forever.
There had been some, and I'm not suggesting that this is linked in any way, but there were two very strange texts on his phone, weren't there? Messages on his phone, because you start to then find out about someone's life, some of the more personal stuff after they've died. What were these text messages about?
Well, I have to put everything in context. Like you said, he was he was extraordinarily fit. Nobody knew him to have any weakness. So to go back to that moment, here he was dead, fitter than any of us. We couldn't explain it. Nobody could explain it. And at some stage, within a couple of hours of that, my brother Fergus checked his phone and he found a couple of texts on it. And they appeared at first quite sinister. Now, I stress, I'm not trying to crank up the drama here, but at that moment, we didn't have a clue what had happened. And, you know, the sort of condition we're talking about that eventually did be identified wasn't really known very much about. So these two messages on his phone, one said, you know, it said, like, you know, you're going down. And another one said, sort of, get ready to die on court. And we thought, well, is this a threat or something? It turned out after some investigations that it was a passing acquaintance had been offering to play him a game of squash.
Oh, for goodness sake.
Yeah. But for that sequence of hours, of a day or so, this was a big mystery.
Oh, for goodness sake.
We couldn't even talk about it in public, you know. And we haven't just talked about it all these years. And I'm not for any minute trying to, you know, mix a bad memory, or sorry, to sort of cause any sort of bad fuss about this. I suppose it's just trying to bring us back to that moment and explain even more so than people would realise.
The confusion.
The absolute bewilderment that we were experiencing.
Cormac has left an important legacy, hasn't he? The Cormac Trust.
He's left an extraordinary legacy in many different things. But, you know, there's a pitch named after him, a cup named after him, a club named after him in Sydney, Australia. There are different initiatives named after him. But the one, I suppose, that my family, my parents in particular, have been most involved in is the Cormac Trust. It was set up in the year after Cormac died to raise awareness of cardiac conditions among young people, to provide defibrillators in the community and to lobby for screening of young people. And it has been a very onerous and trying at times, but a worthwhile journey for them. You know, it's been an extraordinary thing, and it's still going after all these years and still playing an impact on people's lives.
How's your family, Donal? Because this is something, you know, life goes on and you have to smile again and your family has to go on. But how are they?
They're hanging in there. They're tough people. Anybody knows them will know that, you know. They don't get daunted. My father and mother both throw themselves into everything they can. They give it everything.
They take on
too much. They're okay. Yeah, they are. I mean, you know, they're all right. You know, I don't listen to them complaining too much.
Thank you for telling me more about Cormac today. I really appreciate it, Donal, and thank you very much indeed for joining me.